Daniel Pinchbeck is the author of Breaking Open the Head, a psychedelic journey into the heart of contemporary shamanism, and is a regular columnist for Arthur Magazine. He's currently completing a second book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, an Indigenous Prophecies and Consciousness Transformation, to be released next spring. His feature articles have appeared in the New York Time Magazine, Esquire, Wired, The Village Voice, and numerous other publications. A founding editor of Open City, a literary journal, he is currently launching a new magazine and internet forum, Metascene, a magazine for the new edge, offering a new paradigm for a planetary culture. Our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel, is that Metascene or Metascene, spelled with a T instead of a D?
Medicine, spelled with a T, right? It's M-E-T-A-C-I-N-A, sort of a play on medicine.
What kind of magazine is it going to be?
Well, I mean, the basic idea is kind of like to put together an alternative paradigm, sort of economic, ecological, spiritual, shamanic, sort of put together a lot of ideas that people that I know have been exploring really carefully. And take it up to a higher level of evaluation.
Well, you know, there's so much going on here with Hopi prophecy, the Mayans, and just about everything else. It's almost like I don't know which way to start, except the best thing I think for us to do is to talk a little bit about your first book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. Because I think through the shamans who really deal with the consciousness, that these people were able to really tap into what might be going on in the universe. And I think that may be the bearing for all these other things that you've investigated. Am I close on that?
I think definitely. I mean, what happened with the first book is I sort of started out as a secular atheist, materialist, New York journalist. And I went through a series of shamanic investigations. I went to West Africa. I went through tribal initiation in Gabon. Then I went down to the Amazon in Ecuador and visited a Mazatec shaman in Mexico. And began to have, you know, various like psychic and synchronistic and even magical events and occurrences, which by the end of the book had completely changed my view over to the shamanic perspective. And that really became the basis for the next book, because having had these experiences, I then had to question, you know, not only the materialist sort of paradigm, which is the functioning belief system of the modern world, but then also realize that if these other cultures had this other level of knowledge, that we should also take seriously what they're suggesting about what's going to happen in the future.
Because this planet has not necessarily evolved well spiritually, but it has evolved in terms of technologically, do we have more shamans on this planet than we did 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think it's a question of evolving better or worse. I mean, I think everything is going, like, you know, what I ended up, first having gone through a kind of apocalyptic crisis where I freaked out after going to the Amazon and seeing the kind of devastation caused by the oil companies and so on. I went through a kind of, you know, and then reading tons and tons about the ecological problems on the planet. I first got very depressed with what was going on. But my present state of mind, having sort of gone through a whole other process, is that actually everything is going perfectly according to plan, and we're in a kind of evolutionary process. And part of that process is that sort of different aspects of human potential get sort of accessed in different time periods. And we've gone through a time period where kind of the, you know, left brain, rightness, male, rational, dominator kind of mentality has sort of taken over and pushed things in a certain direction and accelerated the evolution of technology. And I would say that part of the fulfillment of the prophecies in 2012 would be a kind of rebalancing of the hemispheres and a kind of equalizing of the intuitive, magical, and spiritual.
Daniel, do you find that the Mayans and the Hopis are matching in some of their prophecies and revelations?
I think it all looks pretty, like, coherent to me. I mean, it looks pretty matched up. If you look at the Mayans, the Hopis, the Aztecs, and even you can throw in the, you know, the Hindus in the Book of Revelation, it actually all looks pretty, like, aligned.
We'll get into the message in a moment, but what would your theory then be why these different cultures, some of them different time periods, would all have similar ends to the same thing? They'd all point in the same direction. How come?
Well, because they were, you know, because the knowledge is available. I mean, if you look at contemporary physics, you know, they talk about how, you know, the space-time we're in is only sort of a one linear form of space-time. There's a kind of transcendent dimension where all things, you know, have already occurred. I mean, the physicist Eddington talked about how events do not really happen. They're just there and we come upon them. And that's exactly what the Hopis say. I mean, they say that all time is present now. So these other cultures had means of kind of beaming into other layers of the onion, in a sense.
Set the stage. What would you prefer that we talk about first, the Mayans or the Hopis?
I guess the Mayans is good.
Okay. Now, let's talk about their culture. Who were these people, Daniel?
Well, the Mayans are located in the Yucatan, and they had a wide-ranging culture. They just developed in the earlier Olmecs. And then they really took off in terms of they became incredibly sophisticated. I mean, in terms of their art, in terms of their spiritual culture, and they left these extraordinary temple cities behind, in Palenque and Tikal and Chichen Itza. And then they very mysteriously and very suddenly disappeared. And, you know, various modern historians and archaeologists have tried to make cases that there was some, you know, sudden ecological collapse. But I don't know how good the evidence for that is, how much we're actually just projecting our own kind of materialist thought structure onto them.
And you know, even though we have heard, of course, that the Mayans were incredibly intelligent, probably way beyond their time, we're also finding out now that their rituals were also pretty barbaric. You know, human sacrifices, part of their religion, part of their beliefs. Is that a fair assessment to say barbaric, or did they actually believe then that they were doing something good?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Mayans, as opposed to the Aztecs, were very limited users of human sacrifice. It wasn't as large-scale a practice. And, I mean, and there was also, I mean, actually, the sort of the story of Quetzalcoatl, who kind of emerged at the end of the Mayan period, is that he actually abolished human sacrifice for a time. But they were always interested in using blood as a kind of psycho-physical magic generator, I guess, to sort of contact other levels of being. And to some extent, that certainly violates contemporary morality. I mean, of course, you know, our civilization is also quite barbaric and sacrifices people in all sorts of ways. So I think we have to be a little careful, you know, about projecting onto them without really having a deeper understanding.
Well, when you say our society, are you talking about the planet?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, I mean, we sacrifice, you know, children in the third world to work in factories to make.
Well, that's what I mean. Then, a planetary.
We don't do direct human sacrifices, but we find other ways to extract toil and blood from people. So I don't think that the classical Maya were actually huge practitioners of human sacrifice. I mean, I think it was a small part of their religious practice.
The year 2012 comes up all the time on this program, Daniel. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of it? I mean, why did it end at 2012? And tell us a little bit about the Mayan calendar in general.
All right. Well, I mean, the Mayans were obsessed with cycles of time. I mean, that's another thing that makes it very strange that they had such a sudden disappearance, and that they were obsessed with huge cycles of time. I mean, if you go back to their, you know, their kind of stelae and stuff, they have hieroglyphs which represent, there's one called the Aloton, which is like 43 million years, and there's another glyph which is the Halopton, which is 1.3 billion years. So they were looking at time in this incredibly macrocosmic scale. And, you know, I'm not an archaeologist, so I can't say from the primary sources, but from the various books that I've read and the people that I've spoken with, the idea is that the Mayan calendar itself kind of ends in 2012, and that there's this kind of psychical progression. And the people who've been examining it to a deep degree, which includes José Aguirelis and the Swedish biologist Carl Johan Kellerman, believe that the Mayans had a kind of fractal model of time that they were looking at as a kind of spiraling process linked to consciousness, and that it goes through these different stages and levels of consciousness evolution, which complete the process on the Earth in 2012.
Now, so many people nowadays interpret 2012 in all kinds of incredible, incredible possibilities. Some say we're going to go through a massive polar shift, and the Mayans knew about that. A magnetic field shift is going to occur. Some say that it's probably the end of time, that maybe we're going to get hit by an asteroid, and the Mayans have prophesied that. Others simply say the calendar ended because it just ended. So with all these possibilities out there, were you able to simulate just what you think might be happening here?
Right. Well, I think that it is going to be a massive transformation in human consciousness to a different level of realization. And I think that's really the key aspect of it. And I think we're going to move into a harmonic and utopian situation on the planet. You know, obviously after passing through some turbulence first. You know, other stuff is, to me seems sort of speculative. I mean, there may be disasters on the way, but I think it's more important. You know, we tend to get very obsessed with the negative in our culture, and I think it's very important to look at the positive aspects. And, you know, I mean, one way that, you know, it's very sort of clear to think about it is that if we're in a period where all of this darkness seems present, it may be because light casts a shadow, and that we're focusing on the shadow rather than seeing the light behind it.
I've always said that it could be a period of enlightenment for all of us.
Right. Well, I think that would be what I would say also. But the question, but the thing about it is that we actually have to do the work. I mean, to bring that into being, and that's something I think that often gets missed when you sort of focus on a date. It sort of feels like it's just going to happen. But actually, I would say it's like an incredible opportunity for us to make something happen. And if we look at the world, I mean, even, you know, I mean, I think it's, I mean, for many reasons, I think that the projection is probably accurate, having thought about all the reasons for it. But even beyond that, it gives us a kind of opportunity to, you know, plan, reshape, rethink. I mean, and to figure out how we're going to move into a different framework, because clearly the, you know, sort of social system we have now is not functioning and is not compassionate and not worth sticking with.
And sometimes whatever that end date is, 2012, maybe it's something cyclical as well. Maybe they were able to predict things occurring, earth changes, because of past cycles.
Well, it's not, yeah, I mean, basically the whole idea is that it's a kind of non-dual perspective, and that the evolution of consciousness on the Earth is synchronized with larger cosmic patterns and cosmic cycles. So one aspect is the kind of, there's an astronomical alignment that happens on December 21st, 2012, where the sun rises during the winter solstice at the dark rift in the center of the Milky Way. And the Mayans talked about this dark rift as being the black hole or the cosmic mother. And, you know, astronomers only in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years discovered there is actually an enormous black hole right at that spot.
So how would they know about it? The Mayans? They didn't have telescopes.
Exactly. Well,
they didn't have anything.
I mean, the two possibilities, which Jenkins and Arguelles kind of discuss, is either they, through visionary psychedelic exploration, had sort of a deeper understanding of kind of energy patterns in the universe, and somehow could sense it, you know, extrasensorily, through ritual use of psychedelics, or they actually are a kind of galactic civilization that sort of appeared at Earth on the Earth at that point to leave all this information about time and synchronicity and harmonic resonances behind for us to kind of pick up again at this point as we pass through this transition.
Well, and I think you're absolutely correct. It's probably one of the other. Either they had some kind of an enlightened period through, as you say, some of these psychedelics, which we'll talk about in a moment, where they were able to travel remote view to do whatever they could do and travel throughout the universe that way. If indeed these theories are correct as well, that we have the ability to do this, they might have been able to do that. Or, as you've said, they were extraterrestrial visitors who came here, or they were visited as well, Daniel. That's a possibility, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, right, or it may also be both or all three, you know. I mean,
right.
The alien may actually manifest to us as us, You know, I mean, that in a way has been an implication of the experiences I've had on the way of doing this.
That leads us, of course, into Quetzalcoatl, who is part of your new book. He came during the Mayans' last period. Who was this person?
Right, well, Quetzalcoatl is one of the creator deities of the Aztecs. I guess he was actually Kukulcan to the Mayans. But he's a kind of figure who was part of the creation myth, in that he went into the underworld and gathered up the bones of destroyed humanity at the end of the fourth sun, which was the previous world cycle, and he sort of carried them tenderly up to the surface and restored them to life. And, you know, literally it's the plumed serpent, or the Quetzal is a sort of rainbow-feathered bird of the region, and Coatl is the serpent. So it, so the Quetzalcoatl as a symbol represents kind of the union of the bird, which is air, heaven, spirit, and the serpent, which is earth, you know, body, matter. So it's an image of heaven and earth integration.
Was he a real person?
Well, there were, you know, much like the Tibetan Buddha of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, has human incarnations, including the present Dalai Lama. And each Dalai Lama is considered to be an incarnation of the Buddha of Compassion. Quetzalcoatl had, on occasion, human incarnations. And he had one in kind of a previous or prehistoric phase of Mesoamerican development, where he was kind of the bearded culture hero who disseminated kind of arts and sciences to the people. And then he had a 10th century incarnation as Acatl, Quetzalcoatl, who sort of was ultimately foiled by the sorcerers of Tezcatlipoca, his nemesis.
You know the names.
Yeah, and ended up sort of prophesying his return on a certain date, which turned out to be the date that Cortez arrived in the New World, which completely kind of destroyed the confidence of Montezuma and the Aztecs, basically just collapsed.
Is it possible that Quetzalcoatl was an alien god or something like that?
Well, I mean, the word alien almost becomes unnecessary. I mean, he was a kind of god form, or in a way a kind of symbolic archetype.
Right.
You know, I mean, one definite sort of lens I'm looking at a lot of this material at through the in the book is the Jungian lens. You know, which is sort of the idea that there are archetypes that constellate or crystallize over time.
Oh, well, I mean, do you think he was a figment of a great Mayan imagination, or do you think he was a real person?
Well, I think that the imagination is the only thing that's real. as William Blake, I think, said. So I would say he was both.
Indeed, he was.
I mean, one of the interesting things about Maya, as Arguelles points out, is that the word itself is a kind of tell, because, you know, in Buddhism and Hinduism, Maya is a very important concept. It means the world of illusion. It also means the magical creative power of the gods. So it's a very strange little quirk that the same word Maya, you know, which has all that meaning in the Eastern philosophy, Zen is the name of this culture in the Western Hemisphere.
We'll come back, talk about this. And part of your investigation, of course, deals with crop formations as well. We'll talk about that when we come back with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. I'm Joe. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with our guest tonight, Daniel Pinchback. Daniel, in your research, of course, you looked into the crop circles, crop formations situation. Let's talk about just why you even approached that angle.
Right. Well, I guess it started, I got interested in it, you know, when I'd sort of written my first book, and I'd had these various kind of shamanic and sort of not demonic, but daimonic kind of experiences. And I wondered, you know, where one could find sort of consensual validation for this kind of worldview. And I realized there was this whole phenomenon going on, which I'd really never paid any attention to. I mean, it really doesn't get any play in the mainstream media. You never see images of it in the Times or anywhere. So, you know, I just, through the Internet, began to look at the patterns, and I was totally astonished by how incredible they were. I mean, just their incredible beauty and their incredible scale. And then I got an assignment from Wired magazine to write about the crop circles. It was, I guess it was around the time that movie, horrible movie Signs, came out.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got to interview a bunch of the researchers and sort of thinkers about it. And then, you know, one of them, this guy Michael Glickman, who's been researching for decades in England, said that he felt that they were linked to a dimensional shift that was had already begun and was going to culminate in the year 2012. And since that was already a subject that fascinated me, I realized I had to go over there. So I went over there for 2 summers and spent a lot of time in the field and talked to everybody I could who was involved with it, including some of the hoaxers, and tried to get a really kind of multi-level perspective on it.
What did the hoaxers tell you? I mean, how were they able to do that and not get seen? What did they say?
Well, I mean, they, you know, there are people who are very strident that humans are entirely responsible for the phenomenon, and that it's a sort of postmodern artwork, and that somehow they're able to, you know, pull them all off virtuosically in the dark. And then there are, you know, other people who say that's fundamentally impossible, that even sort of surveying and laying them out would be a monumental feat. And then there are scientists such as this Dutch physicist, Elcho Hasselhoff, who wrote a book called The Deepening Complexity of Crop Circles. And he's actually published papers in peer-reviewed science journals that demonstrate that the plants are affected in such a way that the patterns that he studied had to be created by a single point source of electromagnetic radiation coming from above. And, you know, his science was good enough that it was, you know, in sort of conventional science papers that are peer-reviewed. So the more I thought about and sort of studied the phenomenon, the more of an incredible conundrum the whole thing seemed to be. And I basically, you know, I reached a point where I couldn't even sleep at night. I was staying in Glastonbury in England.
Which really?
Because it was just so fascinating, and there were so many different perspectives on it. And what finally, my sort of final Satori flash on the subject was that I think that the whole phenomenon is a teaching on the nature of reality that's geared specifically for the kind of Western mindset. And part of this teaching is definitely sort of introducing us into this kind of reality shift that we're going through, or as Michael Glickman says, dimensional shift. And part of it is about the nature of causality itself is changing, in that what basically seems to happen with the crop formations is that whoever comes into that the field and begins to study it, their own mindset gets kind of reflected back to them, sort of magnified. So if somebody comes in and is skeptical, you know, they'll find all of the indications that that patterns are hoaxed. Obviously, the hoaxers will, you know, find everything that corroborates their belief that,
right,
you know, they're the ones with the right attitude. And, you know, people who are sort of new age bliss bunnies will go and have like 13-dimensional channel experiences and feel their DNA is being tuned up by light beings. But if you go in there with a, you know, completely open and, but, you know, skeptical but open perspective, you begin to take in all these different layers of conflicting data. And the pattern itself, the whole phenomenon seems to kind of create this kind of cognitive dissonance, which is typical for a lot of these phenomena. If you look at the alien abductions or, you know, shamanism in general, there's a whole trickster element to it, which seems to be like part, sort of woven into the fabric of it. So I began to realize that the whole thing was an incredible teaching on the nature of reality that has all these other levels. I mean, a lot of the patterns relate to fractals, to scientific ideas, strange attractors, but in many cases they're sort of suggesting, or they seem to be suggesting, a kind of merging of the Western scientific and sort of Eastern metaphysic frameworks into a kind of new synthesis.
We had Hasselhoff on as a guest nearly 4 years ago, and he published articles in some pretty prestigious journals about crop circles and formations. I mean, he looked at it pretty seriously, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, his book is really pretty good. I mean, and another whole element to me relates very much to the Quetzalcoatl symbol. So there's a whole element of the integration of heaven and earth. I mean, there's a whole interest in sacred geometry. There was Gerald Hawkins, who wrote a book about Stonehenge, who was the chief of astronomy at Boston University. He found all of these incredibly complex Euclidean theorems, sort of new Euclidean paradigms, as he studied even really simple formations.
What if we are sharing this planet, Daniel, with in other dimensions, for example, and that sometimes, for whatever reason, it crosses over, maybe crop circles is a way for them to communicate in their dimension, who knows, but somehow it leaks through and we see some of them too. I mean, are some of these things possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to frame it. I mean, you know, my feeling is that it probably is being orchestrated by some kind of federation of galactic intelligence, and that once we get through this strange transition period, we'll get to meet these guys.
and also be able to figure out what these things mean, because I'm sure they're sending us a message, aren't they?
Well, I think there are, yeah, I mean, I think it's possible to tease out some of the messages now, and more of it, you know, comes out as one works deeper into it. I mean, there have also been different sort of forms of the crop circles. There's been these kind of pictograms, which are kind of like alien sign language, and then ones which, as I said, are very much related to sacred geometry, you know, the geometry that's used in Stonehenge and the pyramids. I mean, they're very much related to the stone circles in England, this kind of Neolithic culture,
yes,
which had you know, a deep fascination with the relationship between the Earth and the Moon and the Sun, and kind of placing us in this cosmic harmonic order, which once again relates to the whole Mayan calendar situation, which is basically the idea that we've become kind of desynchronized from natural time. And we've created a sort of calendar and a whole way of thinking about time or way of being in time, which is unnatural.
Well, you know, with all the crop circles, Daniel, with all of them that have occurred, if just one is authentic, then that tells you something dramatic about everything that's been going on. And you don't need to have 20% real, 40% real. All you need is one. That's
yeah,
it.
I mean, you're right. I mean, authentic is a complicated term. But yeah, I definitely think that the entire phenomenon is a teaching, and there's certainly, you know, I mean, evidentially ones that there's really doesn't seem any way that human beings could have made them, and including there was in the year I think 1994 there were several formations which showed a particular alignment to the solar system, and that then turned out to, you know, astronomers looked at it and they projected that was going to be one night in April in 1999. And when that night happened, it would turn out to be the largest solar storm in history, and you could actually see the northern lights from England. And you know, there's no, we don't have any way of predicting a solar storm of that magnitude. So it definitely suggests that we're being keyed into information from other sources.
Why is it that mainstream science on a regular basis hasn't investigated crop formations and really tried to do a thorough job? Or do they simply believe that this stuff is all perpetrated by fraud?
Well, I mean, it's not just the science, but it's also, you know, journalists, media, the sort of mainstream mind. I mean, I think it's very much like, it's very similar to psychedelics in that these areas have had to kind of just develop outside of the dominator paradigm, outside of the mainstream culture. And it's very much, it becomes very much an individual decision whether to become interested in them, to investigate, to care, which to me really suggests a lot about how the transition, you know, is going to sort of manifest itself. It's very much about the individual consciousness being able to exercise its own kind of free-willing curiosity outside of these kind of imposed structures that have kind of limited our frame of reference.
You are a believer in extraterrestrial life, I guess, right?
Well, I'm not really a believer in anything, but...
What?
I mean, it seems completely plausible that there, you know, could be galactic intelligences, and it seems like the way they would manifest would be in a much subtler way than, you know, tin cans spiraling around, you know, as UFOs. I mean, I think that as our minds stretch, we will begin to encompass these other realities. But it happens in very subtle domains to begin with.
Now you said something pretty fascinating to me, though, that you're not a believer in anything. Is that until you find the right proof?
Right. I mean, I totally agree with Carl Jung, who said, "I believe only what I know." You know, I mean, once I've had an experience and I know it, then you know, I can support it. You know,
the entire area, and I'm going to devote next hour to talking to you about the Hopi, and then some other issues too. But this crop formation phenomena, since it occurred, has really got me baffled, quite frankly. We have a reporter who does a pretty thorough job investigating these, Daniel, Linda Moulton Howe. She's convinced that they're coming from outside sources. And I just think it seems to be leading more and more directly to something dimensional, some kind of communication from the universe. If all that is true, what the heck are they trying to tell us? I mean, why are they doing this?
Right. Well, I mean, I look at the Jungian perspective, which is like, you know, the process that we're going through, which is also, in a way, the process of apocalypse itself. It's kind of a sidereal movement of consciousness. You know, he talks about the mandala, which comes up in dreams a lot, and it's a symbol of wholeness. And, you know, a lot of the circles are kind of mandala patterns. And the mandala as a symbol of wholeness cannot be approached directly. There's a kind of sidereal or spiraling movement as one approaches it. And that's what I think we're going through, you know, on many levels. And that's part of the crop circle phenomenon. And, you know, as I said, I think they're trying to tell us that we are on the verge of integrating esoteric wisdom traditions with modern scientific knowledge. And that once we do that, which is also an integration of kind of left and right hemisphere, intuitive and rational thought, feminine and masculine aspects, heaven and earth, once we manage to accomplish that integration, we move into this new framework of consciousness where, you know, things are possible that we can't even imagine from this point.
I wonder what they think of us as a society, as people.
Well, I think Michael Glickman was telling me that he sort of investigated from all angles. And he went to a channel or medium in L.A. who was able to contact the crop circle intelligences, and he asked them, you know, what do you guys think of us? And they answered, the sort of collective troop, well, we think you're hilarious. They said basically that they see us as kind of like bumbling figures in an old movie, kind of like Laurel and Hardy.
Well, at least they have a sense of humor, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the crop circles, I think, have an incredible sense of humor. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. I mean, the phenomenon, and it's really also, it's very much about learning how to pay attention. It's very much about specificity. And I feel that that's very much about what's happening in terms of the change in consciousness, is that, you know, what we have in terms of our mainstream paradigm is this kind of imposition of an abstract grid of rationality. But what actually seems to be indicated is learning to just pay more and more particular, careful attention to subtler levels of reality. So, I mean, in these crop circles, there are these little nests in the center, which, you know, are sort of presented like incredible artworks, sort of woven together strand by strand. I mean, there are all these little details to the whole thing, or they'll find one thistle plant in a huge field of wheat, and they'll center the whole formation right on this one thistle plant, which they won't touch.
Well, you're talking about consciousness, and it sounds like you have a cold, Dan. You're going to be okay for
coffee. I'm good.
Okay. Get yourself a little cough medicine, sit by, and stick around for a couple more hours. the ability for people, I think, to investigate, to communicate, one day may become well known to all of us. As like you say, they think we're funny, quite frankly. Right now we're in our, it's like looking at a funny baby, even though some of the things we do on this planet are pretty darn sad and serious. The visitations, do you believe that we have been visited by extraterrestrials?
I think it's possible. I mean, I'm really into the whole Terence McKenna idea of the, you know, he had this sort of contact with the mushroom,
right,
as a kind of alien or galactic probe or alien mind, and you know, I do think that the Mayan culture probably does represent some other level of galactic intelligence. I mean, as does the Tibetan Buddhists. I mean, they, you know, they completely talk about being in contact with you know, kind of Buddhas from Buddha fields and sort of hyperdimensional spaces and stuff.
And a lot of this contact, though, is based on using psychedelics. Who's to say that the mind hasn't just created this because of the use of the psychedelics?
Right. Well, I mean, I support the, there's this physicist, Amit Goswami, wrote a book called Self-Aware Universe, following up on the Tao of Physics by Friedrich Capra. I mean, it's a whole now well-developed line of thinking in physics that the only way to really explain all of the paradoxes of quantum physics is to begin with the consciousness being fundamental to reality, and the consciousness is actually, on a certain level, creating reality, self-organizing into sort of back into its original kind of state of freedom and full potentiality. So that's what I think is going on. So in a sense, yeah, the mind has created the whole thing.
But does it need mood-altering psychedelics to do that, or can we do it without that?
Well, I mean, the Tibetans do it without it. But I definitely think they can be useful as tools.
Maybe they augment it even grander than you could without it.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. I mean, I think that the Western consciousness is a more investigative, kind of pragmatic, tool-oriented consciousness than the East. So, you know, these are tools, and they're also, you know, provided naturally by the planet for our investigation.
But, you know, when you hear the word psychedelic, a lot of people think we're talking about drugs. You're talking about people using drugs. That's not the case, is it?
Language is very powerful, and that language really shapes reality.
Yes.
So, you know, when you use a language like that, then you shape the reality in a certain way, which also shapes the kind of experience that you can have. I would say that they're tools and they're medicines. You know, I think ayahuasca, which is the one from the Amazon, is, an incredible medicine for kind of healing the spirit and the soul.
Well, and shamans swear by it, if I could use that word. Your website, breakingopenthehead.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The book we're talking about, the other one, the new book that are you close to completing that?
Yeah, it's almost done.
And when do you think it'll hit the stands?
It won't be out for another year.
Okay, so it will be next spring, not this spring.
Exactly.
All right, stay with us. Daniel Pinchbeck, our guest. We're going to talk about the Hopi prophecy when we come back, open up Fast Blast later on, and then take phone calls our last hour, give you an opportunity to chat with him. And still there's much more to talk about with the Mayans. And, that 2012 date, I keep looking at it. It's not that far away. The clock just keeps ticking. Daniel, there seems to be an incredible fascination with the Book of Revelation. You've looked at this as well. Does this tie in also to Mayan and Hopi prophecy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all works pretty amazingly, you know, synchronistically together. I mean, the concept of moving into a new Jerusalem, I would say, would be the same as the Hopi fifth world. I mean, they believe we're in the fourth world and transitioning to the fifth world. And the same as the, you know, sort of Mayan shift in 2012 into a kind of enlightened, compassionate state for humanity.
You know, some people have interpreted the Book of Revelation as being not all that bad for mankind, and I keep going back and reading it, and it doesn't look like a good period for us. What's your take?
Right. Well, I mean, literally the apocalypse means uncovering or revealing, which means that basically everything gets kind of, upsurged and vomited forth so for everyone to see. And I think that we can see that is, to a certain extent, happening right now, and that things are becoming very, very transparent and obvious. And really, there's no place to hide and no place to run. I personally think that, you know, the World Trade Towers falling very much seems to be something that was prophesied in Revelation 11.
And Nostradamus probably as well.
Right, I actually can never deal with Nostradamus somehow. You know, you have to go with the prophecy stuff that you vibe with, and I just can't vibe with Nostradamus.
Okay, all right, that's fair enough.
So I think we're in this period, which culminates in this transformation of consciousness. And definitely it looks like it's going to get, you know, rough. That's also, according to this guy, Carl Johan Kalman's reading of the Mayan calendar, there are these sort of cycles at various scales that get sort of smaller and smaller as we approach this date. And in each of these smaller cycles, there's a kind of alternation of dark and light energy currents. And he places the sort of dark energy current around 2008, 2009, and suggests that we might go through a kind of global financial collapse at that point. And, I mean, personally, I almost think that's something to hope for as the kind of predatory and parasitic nature of the economy and the technosphere are damaging the biosphere at a really quick rate. So we would sort of hope for something to slow that down, which would also give us the time to kind of recuperate and to constellate a kind of new vision for what planetary culture could be. And I think, you know, that, I mean, for me, one interesting tool for that would be to think about time and the clock. And if we think about the Gregorian calendar, this was José Arguelles' point, is completely desynchronized. I mean, originally back, you know, before Mesopotamia, people followed a lunar calendar, which was precisely oriented to lunar cycles. And those, they were also sort of under the Great Mother. I mean, the moon represents the sort of feminine. So they worshipped the Great Mother, and they precisely followed a lunar calendar. When the sort of civilizations of Mesopotamia came up, they switched to a patriarchal dominator mindset and a kind of solar calendar, where they divided the circle into 360 degrees and tried to create 12 perfect months, which didn't work. So they ended up making calendars that were no longer synchronized to natural cycles. And Arguelles' point is that the calendar is a kind of metaprogramming device for the human mind that entrains us to a certain way of being in reality. So if we're following a desynchronized calendar, although we don't realize it, it sort of drives us all subtly insane and progressively desynchronizes us from experience of natural time. So he proposed a calendar, the 13 moon calendar, which I think is very interesting and has validity and is kind of based on the Mayan system.
Okay.
But I think ultimately we're going to have to create a new calendar that would, I mean, it's not a project for one person. It would require a kind of global meeting of minds, like technicians.
Everything would have to change. Everything.
Well, the great thing about the new calendar is that if we instituted it and we made it a global standard, completely synchronized to natural cycles, really carefully worked out,
right,
bringing in Islamic traditions, indigenous, you know, Judeo-Christian astronomers, once that new time was instituted, we could make it retroactive as well as projective. So all of the kind of agglomeration of nation-state charters, of corporate debt structures, third-world debt structures, all of that stuff could be just eliminated at one fell swoop.
They're going to have to
start again with a new harmonic paradigm.
I tell you what, they're going to have to eliminate our debt structure too. You know, ours is going to be worse off than all the others combined the way we're going.
Right. Well, I mean, it may reach the point where this whole idea of this kind of abstract value imposed on reality just becomes untenable. And, we know at the moment, I think 200 billionaires control more wealth than like three-quarters
yes.
of the planet's population. So, I mean, this is clearly an insane situation.
Would we be talking about a 13-month calendar? Would that...
Unfortunately, the 13-moon calendar doesn't quite work because the moon doesn't actually circle the sun precisely 13 times
right.
a year. There's a full moon cycle, which is like 29.6 or something, and there's another one which is like 28.2, which is past a fixed star. So it really is a technical, it's kind of both a spiritual and a technical problem.
Would we have to change the entire 12-month structure then?
Sure. Yeah. We would go into a new time. And doing that, we would delegitimize all of the malfunctioning institutions that have operated. It would really be like the seal on this new consciousness transformation. It would give us a new basis from which to begin.
Maybe we can change our age. Maybe I can drop down to 30 or something. Huh?
Whatever you want to be.
but you are right. It would take an effort, I think, of everyone to be involved in something. That indeed is a planetary decision, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, I mean, looking at this kind of archetype, you know, these different archetypes like the apocalypse, I mean, Glastonbury has a huge number of myths around it, and there's one which is about, you know, the 12 tribes of Glastonbury combining to sort of weave a 13th tribe and install a New Jerusalem. I mean, there's this whole 12-13 thing which plays through a lot of fairy tales and folk tales and myth, including King Arthur and the 12 Knights, or Christ and the 12 Disciples.
Yes, you're right.
You know, it's in Sleeping Beauty, the 13th wise woman who's not invited, who then curses the kingdom. So this is somehow a basic underlying structure, and it seems to be really referring specifically to this calendar problem. And Glastonbury seems like a place, especially since all the stone circles are kind of around there, where it could be a kind of global meeting to come up with a new concordance. This is an idea that I'm putting forth in my book anyway as a kind of solution.
Would it be easy or difficult to change, assuming you had cooperation?
I think it would be easy. I think it would be. I mean, people would really have to understand that the time we're now is, you know, desynchronized. And then they would feel the kind of natural need for change. And if you think about, you know, how we live in time, I mean, this is a whole other aspect of my book. You know, we've constructed a kind of linear, spatialized time. And the way we think about time is we talk about time as an amount. You know, you have enough time, you're wasting time, you're spending time, you're running out of time. And that's our conventional conception of time, but actually time is not like that at all. It underlies space. It's different than space.
Tell me a little bit about the Hopis and their prophecy. Of course, some of it is kind of startling, quite frankly. But who were the Hopi tribe?
Well, who are the Hopi tribe? There, you can still go visit them.
Yeah.
I went and visited them last summer. I mean, they're out in New Mexico.
How many of you members?
It's about 12,000.
12,000, okay.
They live on these mesas in this incredible desert landscape, which really looks like the surface of Mars or something. And they are subsistence farmers. I mean, they have certain crops which they grow in this land, which is a pretty remarkable feat. And, I mean, they are considered to be the original dwellers on the American continent. Chaco Canyon is an incredible sort of sculpted canyon that is a bit like Stonehenge and Avebury, that it sort of uses the sun and the moon, follows their tracks in various ways. So they have a very sophisticated ritual, spiritual culture with different sort of secretive clans, and they feel very exploited and kind of maltreated by modern society. I mean, they're, you know, from what I understand, their original way of being is completely non-hierarchical, and to a certain extent telepathic. And even anthropologists who've studied them, like Cambridge anthropologists who studied them in recent years, feel that they've retained this kind of telepathic level. I mean, this anthropologist would go, he would get his questions together, and he would go to visit one of the elders, and the elder would start answering all of the questions before he could formulate them. And I, you know, it's definitely a very sacred and amazing landscape. And so they have this emergence myth, which is basically there have been three previous worlds. We're now in the fourth world. They have a set of oral prophecies about how the fourth world will end. Almost all of these prophecies have now been fulfilled.
Now, what's the definition of a world?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I don't have a complete answer for you. Whether that means a form of consciousness, whether that means an actual incarnation of the earth,
Or an end of a particular civilization or era,
or an end of a cycle,
or a cycle for something that maybe, for example, when the asteroid hit 65 million years ago, wiped out the dinosaurs, maybe that was the end of a world. I don't know.
I mean, I've also been looking a lot at the ideas of Rudolf Steiner, who was this Austrian visionary philosopher in the 19th century. And he also, although I don't think he even knew about the Hopis, he said there have been three previous worlds. We were currently in the fourth world, moving towards transition to the fifth world. And he ascribed names to these worlds based on sort of planets. Like he called the next incarnation was going to be the Jupiter incarnation. And he described very specifically, or in kind of esoteric terms, like some of the changes that were going to take place. Like he said that the organ of generation, you know, procreation, was going to move from the sex organ to the throat chakra, so that we'd actually be kind of communicating or singing beings like ourselves into existence.
That's fascinating.
I mean, he had a whole series of ideas like that, which begin to make more and more sense to me the more I sit with them. And especially if you think about ayahuasca or DMT, where you see this kind of visual language, as Terence McKenna also kind of went into. I don't know. It seems to me there's something there.
In the emergence to the fifth world, if I've studied a Hopi prophecy correctly, they say some pretty startling things about this planet, right?
In what sense?
Well, do they talk about the possibility of a third world war?
Yeah, they say that there's going to be. I mean, we may already be in this war. They say a war fought with material means over spiritual matters that will end in the destruction of the United States. Land and peoples.
By atomic bombs, they say, don't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, but there, you know, there you're sort of like looking at, I mean...
Or is that interpretation?
Well, it's not interpretation, but prophecy is also, you know, something that evolves over time. I don't think there are prophecies from thousands of years ago talked about radiation and atomic bombs. I mean, apparently they did have this prophecy about a gourd of ashes falling on a city.
Yes.
They thought was realized by Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But again, I think it's a little more complicated in that sort of the prophecy is for them part of the, I mean, anyone who speaks in their tribe has access to the prophecy and can kind of shape it. I mean, they have the basic format of the myth, but then it sort of evolves over time. But I mean, I think that the basic outline, you know, which coheres so well to the Aztec idea of the fifth sun and all these other ideas, seems to be very fundamentally sound.
They believe, though, that this destruction will occur sooner than later.
Right. See, once again, I mean, you're stressing the destruction.
Right.
And I try not to stress that because I think that that is like just a trip, you know, sort of like a mind trip that we like to go on.
Well, yeah, but Daniel, you can't ignore it. I mean,
no, of course you can't. But I mean, for me, when I went down there, I mean, I had this interest in understanding their prophecies, and I did finally get the oral transmission of the prophecy from one of their elders. But what I began to realize when I read about them was about this Peabody coal mining company, which has this concession on their land, which is siphoning out a billion gallons of water a year from their aquifer.
I know the company well. They're based in Illinois.
That's right, the pipeline built by Enron. And I realized that, you know, we're focusing our energy on the wrong place. We're worried about the destruction. If we could stop the pipeline and make a great relationship with the Hopi and become the Pahana, the elder white brother they've been waiting for, then I think we wouldn't have to spend all of our time neurotically focused on destruction. We could actually begin to move towards creation and construction, which is where we need to go really, really quickly.
Or are you saying that the prophecy are things that will be or could be?
Well, I'm saying that mind is the basis of reality. So it's really where you want to put your stress, you know. And I put my stress on the positive, creative possibilities. And I think that there's still time to work with them and to, you know, mitigate the bad stuff and to actually make a proper relationship. And I think it's clear that we have as much to learn from these indigenous cultures. You know, well, I mean, who knows what they have to learn from us, but we definitely have a lot to learn from them about how to work with the earth, which is what they said, you know, they were sort of protecting, the knowledge they were protecting, and also about how to create a non-hierarchical society based on telepathic communion rather than hierarchical dominance.
Well, but when they say that the United States will be destroyed, are they saying, am I interpreting this as being a physical destruction, or is it more of a destruction of ideology, and maybe that's going to change.
Well, there you go. Now you've moved into a more positive framework on thinking about these things. You know, it's really a question of the kind of, since, as I said, from my perspective, we're creating reality. You know, we're articulating it. We're drawing it into existence. So let's draw positive reality into existence rather than constantly being focused on negativity. So, yeah, maybe it's destruction of ideology. Maybe, you know, radiation is food irradiation, and it's already affected those people it's going to affect who have been eating, you know, huge amounts of cow for the last 15 years.
Well, you know, you see things like farmers in Europe opposed to taking genetically modified seed, but they don't want to use it. And I see that as possibility, as a trend. It's not happening in this country, unfortunately. But, I mean, they're trying to stand pat.
Yeah.
That could be part of the prophecies, too.
Which could be the...
you know, trying to avoid taking, like, genetically
totally
modified foods and things like
that. I mean, basically, what's going to come to pass is going to come to pass. And, but, you know, we have the time and the possibility to focus our energy in more or less positive ways. And, you know, what I would like to see in the future is actually, you know, I think that our Western consciousnesses have evolved enough. I mean, the 60s, we sort of went there as hippies, and they ended up having to pass, like, anti-hippie ordinances, you know, where we can actually go to the tribe like the Hopi and try to really create a true partnership, recognizing that there are aspects of the soul, aspects of the earth, that they understand that we need to learn from at this point in time. And then maybe they would be interested in some of our, you know, more sophisticated kind of symbiotic technologies, where we're actually trying to work with nature rather than just work against nature.
The Hopi, when they came up with these prophecies, again, with this through their own shamans?
Yeah, I think that the prophecy, and my understanding of it is that, you know, it's really based on attunement to reality as it is. And the deeper that you're attuned to reality as it is, the more you're already in a prophetic mind state.
That's fascinating. Well, stay with us. I'm going to open up Fast Blast now to give you an opportunity to ask us a question. I'll pass that right on to Daniel Pinchback. And then at the top of the hour, we'll just simply open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with him, too. There's lots more to talk about here. I want to get in next, of course, into the thoughts of some of these psychedelics. We touched on them in the beginning. You know, and the possibility. Should they be legalized? Should they not? Are they? Some of them. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with our guest, Daniel Pinchback, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel, let's talk a little bit, and then we're going to go to some Fast Blast questions here for you. Of these psychedelics, again, we only touched on it an hour ago. The ayahuasca, that there are some people who have used it. I think David Icke told me he's tried it before, and a number of other people as a psychedelic. What does this do to people when they take it?
Well, I mean, what does it do to you? It sort of relaxes you, and then it sort of introduces you into a kind of visionary reality. It's a little bit kind of a waking dream vision. I mean, my recent experiences of it was I went down to Brazil and worked with a religion based in the Amazon called the Santo Daime, which weaves together indigenous and Christian elements. And they use it pretty differently than tribal societies do, where you sort of lie in a hammock and the shaman will sing through the night and you'll see visions. Their ceremonies are larger. They're under these kind of bright fluorescent lights, and you all sing together or dance together. And they kind of use it as a way to create astral machinery, in a way, or move astral machinery. The religion was started by a rubber tapper in the 1920s, and he took it with indigenous tribes and began to see the mother of the forest, or the Virgin Mary, and she gave him all these hymns to sing. And the hymns kind of call in these different spiritual presences. So you'll sing this hymn about the mother of the forest, and then you'll begin to perceive this kind of vast astral feminine being kind of twirling over your head, sort of blessing you and being with you during the ceremony. So I found it a very magical and very useful way of taking this medicine.
Some countries are using this on a pretty regular basis, but it is illegal here in the United States, right?
Well, there's some very complicated legal battles now going on. There's two main Brazilian religions, Santo Daime and Unão de Vegetalis. Unão de Vegetalis, the American head is Jeffrey Bronfman, who's one of the heirs to the Seagram's family fortune.
Right.
And he's been bringing the tea in for years, but I guess it was seized a few years ago, and he's been in a long battle, he's actually won throughout the federal court system. And it may go to the Supreme Court, I'm not exactly sure of the status about it at the moment, to have the tea protected as the use of the sacrament in religious practices, much like peyote in the Native American church.
Can it hurt you? I mean, is there a possibility of...
It doesn't seem to have any possibility to hurt you. I mean, they did studies on the Brazilian religions when they were thinking about whether or not to kind of legalize it there, and they found that people in the religion were generally healthier, happier, you know, they didn't beat their wives, they had less psychological problems, so they gave it the green light.
Interesting. Indeed. In you grind it from the plant?
Yeah, actually, when I was down in the Amazon, part of our sort of initiation process was we learned how to make it, which was really, really fun. It's two components. There's the leaves of a plant, Psychotria viridis, and this thick jungle vine, Banisteriopsis capi. And the leaves represent the feminine aspect, and the vine is the masculine aspect. And when you are working on the medicine, you sing and you also drink some of the ayahuasca. So you get into this highly attuned state where you really feel like the plant is actually teaching you how it wants to be worked with.
What's it taste like, Dave? in you?
I got to like the taste. At first, it seemed awful to me, and also it often makes people throw up when they the first times they take it. But in the end, you know, it always made me shudder a little bit. It's a little bitter, you know. It's definitely jungle, you know, stuff brewed together. It's really not so bad.
How quickly does it affect you?
You know, the one cup probably lasts like 3 or 4 hours. When you do these Daime cups, I guess it comes on in about an hour. They continue through the night. You may drink like 3 or 4 cups in a night, and they're also pretty much expert on dosages and some ceremonies. Like as we went deeper into the Amazon, the medicine got stronger and stronger.
Can you function, or do you have to just lie down, you know, after you've taken this?
Well, you actually completely can function. I mean, some of these ceremonies that they do, people stand up and dance for 12 or 13 hours.
I mean, would you recommend you get in a car and drive around?
I definitely would not recommend driving around in a car.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in terms of the ability to travel, let's say astrally, for example, after you've taken this, does it kind of release the consciousness a little bit better than someone who might not be using this?
Yeah, definitely. It loosens your consciousness like a loose tooth or something. Definitely. I mean, you know, are definitely given access to other realms. That's why it's, you know, it can, you know, it's really nice to do it in a ceremony where somebody has proper intention and is kind of sort of trying to bring the energy upwards and keep it centered. I mean, it's an incredible tool, and I definitely hope that Bronfman wins his case and that it becomes possible to do it here. I think it could be a very powerful medicine for kind of healing the sick Western condition.
Well, what other psychedelics are out there?
There's a huge number. I mean, as I wrote about in Breaking Open the Head, there's Sasha Shulgin, who is a scientist who spent like 30 or 40 years creating new psychedelic compounds and compiling them in these huge books. A lot of them are not even illegal. They're just sort of unknown. There's obviously LSD, the mushrooms, peyote, San Pedro, morning glory seeds. I mean, it's pretty astonishing how, you know, large a profusion of the botanical world wants to work with us in this way. You know?
Does the animal world use these? I mean, that is a bizarre question, but I mean, if it's out there in the wild, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if animals, you know, touch these too.
I think they do. I think there's a Italian researcher, Giorgio Sammarini, who's done some work on that subject, but it's not something that particularly interested me, so I didn't really look into it.
All right, let's go to some fast blasts here and ask you a question or two. Let's see. Oh, here's some people are saying the Hopi are in Arizona, not New Mexico.
Yeah, that's probably right. I have terrible geography.
Ah, okay. All right. LSD, that's a psychedelic. During the 70s, of course, we were all told that stuff will kill you. You do not believe that. Tell me about it.
Right. When LSD was first discovered and sort of used in the 50s and early 60s, it was actually considered a wonder drug. It was considered astonishingly safe, and it was being used in all these different therapeutic ways to treat alcoholics and so on. It was only when the genie got out of the bottle and mass consumption started that, I mean, once again, I think with psychedelics, since they're mind manifesting chemicals and mind amplifiers, how we construct our kind of discourse around them and how language is used around them actually really affects even what happens to people when they take these trips. So when mainstream magazines began to report that these were going to drive you insane and make you kill yourself and so on, you know, that also started happening. And, you know, definitely LSD can be incredibly potent. We know that from the 60s, and it should, you know, I mean, actually there's no legal way to use it whatsoever pretty much at this point.
Remember the CIA? CIA gave it to somebody who jumped out of a window or something like that? I don't know.
Or
if
was
you remember
pushed
that.
Out of a window.
Pushed.
I mean, that's a whole complicated story.
Or bumped out of a window?
I mean, I actually think, I mean, one thing I keep thinking about is the origin of LSD is so fascinating. It was discovered in 1938 by this Sandoz chemist, Albert Hofmann, and didn't seem to do anything. They were synthesizing ergot fungus, and he shelved it. And then 5 years later in Basel, in the middle of the Second World War, he began to have dreams about the molecular structure of LSD, and it was the first time he'd ever gone back and resynthesized something that hadn't shown any ability. And then somehow he got some on his hands or swallowed a little bit and had the first unintentional LSD trip. And that was 1943. It was, you know, sort of like, to me, there's an interesting kind of almost like archetypal, newospheric kind of moment here where if you think about Europe at that point with the Nazis and the Final Solution and the Holocaust, and then Albert Hofmann kind of opens the gates on this other tool for consciousness right in the middle of that whole thing. And actually the first intentional LSD trip that he took was the day that the Nazis invaded the Warsaw Ghetto to shut it down. I don't know, it just for me that has a lot of resonance.
If you're not going to use these for tools to reach your consciousness and to let it do what it's supposed to do, do you recommend people even trying that then?
If I don't really recommend anything with psychedelics. I don't think it's really my place. I mean, it's such an individual decision, and obviously the legal structure is completely against it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Next up, Hadron from Connecticut wants to know, how did you get initiated into shamanic practice? How did that all come about?
Yeah, well, basically I went through a massive, I mean, I write about this in Breaking Open the Head. I went through a massive spiritual crisis where I couldn't see the point to my New York cynical lifestyle. And then I sort of went back into my past and tried to figure out where I'd had any kind of access to other experiences of consciousness, other dimensions. And I remembered psychedelic experiences from college. So then I started to get some magazine assignments. And, you know, probably the one that sort of put me over the edge was going down to West Africa, to Gabon, with a botanist and going through an initiation ceremony there where my whole past was kind of revealed to me in a different way. And after that, I went for another magazine down to the Amazon in Ecuador. So that was really my entry was journalistic.
Have any of the shamans or the people you've talked to, Daniel, have they talked about the soul in anything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, on many levels. I mean, there's soul loss, soul retrieval. I mean, these are shamanic practices. You know, the idea is that, you know, as we go through our life sort of pattern, you know, when we have crises or cataclysms or, you know, it could be magical attack, I guess, also, you know, sometimes a little piece of our soul gets kind of trapped or left behind. So shamans can become experts at retrieving the soul, kind of weaving it back into a whole, you know, helping us to unify.
Somewhat controversial, but James Arthur, a past guest on Coast to Coast, believes that the mushroom was basically representing Jesus and Santa Claus. You've heard that?
Well, definitely Santa Claus. I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, that's pretty obvious. Because the red and white capped mushroom, the Siberian shamans, which was loved by the reindeer who would come from miles around, and, you know, that was their, you know, that mushroom would dispense gifts from the other world to the shamans. So that seems to be pretty clear. The Jesus one is a little more complicated. I mean, there was a famous book by John Allegro, which was massively criticized, I think ruined his career, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. But there definitely were, you know, frescoes, indications there was a mushroom cult in early Christianity, sort of related to Gnosticism. You know, I don't know if that goes back directly to Christ. I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff sort of circulating about that he also wrote, that he also ate bread that was infected with mad rye, which was also a form of ergot, which is close to LSD. You know, if you talk to the UDV, the United Vegetalists, this ayahuasca religion, they think there's a sort of ayahuasca-based aspect to the Temple of Solomon. And, you know, so it gets all contrived and complex. You know, we only know what we know.
I wonder how the shamans even stumbled across things like ayahuasca. I mean, who would even think about that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because ayahuasca involves brewing together these two plants that don't seem to have any connection to each other in a very specific way. And, you know, obviously there are millions of plants in the jungle. But if you ask the shamans, they just say that the vine told them how to do it and told them what to do. You know, and I pretty much imagine that's the case, that, you know, they were in some trance state or just sleeping. And just as Albert Hofmann received the, you know, the kind of molecular message from LSD, I'm sure the shamans receive the message from the plants as to what to do.
Tell us a little bit more about that prophetic transmission you got while you were in Brazil.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, basically during one of these Santo Daime ceremonies, and I went down to, first I went to Brasilia, and I was incredibly miserable in the Santo Daime ceremonies at first because they were so religious. It was very hard for me to get around to it. And eventually I kind of learned to surrender to it. And then I actually learned to love the music and realized there was something really important going on. But during the Santo Daime ritual where I was hating the whole experience. And I went outside and I was walking around and I was thinking that I was back in the ceremony. I was just thinking about the Mayans. And I had all these kind of strange synchronistic experiences, like, for instance, with Jose Arguelles, when I contacted him, he mapped me into his calendar system, and it turned out that we were perfect helping partners. He's a blue spectral monkey, and I'm a yellow spectral star. And also, my birthday, June 15th, was the day, June 15th, 1953, I guess it was, when they opened the tomb of Pakalvotan, which for him was key to this whole discovery of this time code. So there was that, and then also when I was in England studying the crop circles, one day the first time I went into Stonehenge, which had various levels of resonance to me, I also had this thinking about my name. Pinchbeck is my last name, and it's actually an English word. One of my ancestors was a kind of alchemist, and he invented a kind of false gold, which became Pinchbeck gold, and the name anything also came to mean anything false or spurious, and it suddenly occurred to me that that was a very strange synonym for the concept of Maya, which means kind of world of illusion or a kind of false world. And it suddenly dawned on me that I was somehow knitted into this whole narrative that I thought I was more or less journalistically investigating. And then when I was down in Brazil, I basically started to receive a transmission of a prophecy related to the return of Quetzalcoatl, which then took a week or so to sort of fully download and write out, and that'll be part of my book.
Some have believed that Quetzalcoatl is also Jesus. Do you believe that at all?
Well, I don't think he's also Jesus. I mean, I suppose on some higher level, I mean, you know, there's this kind of idea there's ultimately a kind of unitary consciousness. But, I mean, just as there's a differentiation between, you know, Buddha and Jesus, I would think there's also differentiation between Buddha, Jesus, and Quetzalcoatl. It's kind of different manifestations of, you know, consciousness or divine consciousness or some access to the sacred. I mean, my understanding of Quetzalcoatl was really that it was a kind of vibrational level of consciousness, and it was the level we would reach when we were integrating the Eastern spiritual traditions with all of that, which is, you know, a highly elaborate system of thought, including reincarnation and so on, with our Western scientific, technical knowledge, and that's when we will reintegrate and create heaven and earth. You know,
Gene from Houston wants to know if crop formations and circles might not be messages for people on this planet, but messages for other extraterrestrials passing through Earth. That's interesting.
It's possible. I don't know what to say about that.
Okay, let's go on to a few others here. John from Wichita says, look, I used to take LSD. It's bad. I used to take it during high school. It's been 15 years since I touched the stuff, and I would not wish the bad effects on anyone. What are the bad effects for, let's say, LSD?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we have this big problem in our culture that also obviously became clear in the 60s, too, that it's a very consumer-based culture, and people aren't given good direction. I mean, the government just says, don't take this stuff, you know, and doesn't give anyone any help. I mean, there's no support structure for having these experiences. And especially for young people, I think it's a natural inclination to alter consciousness. I mean, I think it's basic, fundamental to human beings. And Andrew Weil pointed that out really, really well. So they're in this culture that frowns on, you know, any altered states. So then they start grabbing for what's around them, and they overuse it. And definitely LSD is a very potent mind amplifier and can open you into all these different levels of consciousness that you just may not be ready to explore or to integrate. This is why Timothy Leary in the 60s had the idea that there should be professional therapeutic class that would be sort of like a therapeutic shamanic class that would work with people in altered states. And I think that once we come to our senses about this material, that's what we'll do. And I think that these agents, these substances, these medicines can be profound deconditioning agents to help reformat kind of our society.
And you do not consider cocaine or heroin psychedelics, right?
Definitely not.
Okay.
I mean, they definitely have powerful spirits attached to them, but I think they're very, very negative spirits.
I think you're right about that, too. Daniel, what do you recommend for people who go to your website? What are some of the things they should look for?
Well, the fun thing on the website is the discussion board, which has been an ongoing, fabulous sort of discourse by numerous voices on all of these subjects. And I've definitely learned like a huge amount from the people who've come through there.
Yeah, me too. Same thing for me. I mean, some of the feedback you get, very important, I think, for change and development. And you're probably getting the same thing. You know?
Definitely.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour with our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck. And you know the numbers, but if you don't, we'll give them to you in just a moment as well. If you need to email me ever, it's george@coast2am.com with our guest tonight, Daniel Pinchbeck. His website, breakingopenthehead.com, linked up with his name right now on Coast to Coast. His most current book is called Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. And then next year, around this time, he'll have another book out. And we'll probably have him back when the book's out. I had read, Daniel, that Turtle Island, one of the Fijis, that the Hopis said that if it turned over two or three times, the oceans could join hands and meet the sky. Some say that that could mean a prophecy of a pole shift. Some of the Hopi prophecies, of course, did include Earth changes. Have you looked at that one at all?
I haven't really looked at that one. I mean, once again, I mean, I guess I've just been approaching it from a more kind of psychic perspective.
Type.
I mean, the John Major Jenkins, who writes about 2012 from the Mayan perspective, he thinks that this astronomical alignment they're looking at is actually a kind of movement across the galactic equator, which might have, it's sort of like we cross over the midline of the Milky Way across through the Stark Rift, and that might have effects on a kind of psychophysical level, just as, you know, there's effects below and above the equator now, that and that currents run differently, you know, water flows in the other direction and so on. So, you know, who knows? I mean, I strongly feel that the essential element is that it's a change in the nature of consciousness, but that a change in the nature of consciousness can only be accomplished consciously. Can't be accomplished unconsciously. Therefore, the work that we have to do is very powerful and direct up until that time, which is somehow pull ourselves into alignment and then work to get the planet into a harmonic state.
The shamans that practice what they practice, how did they become what they are, shamans? How did
right.
that
well,
happen?
Some of them are born into shamanic families, but a lot of them go through spontaneous initiations. They'll be sick, they'll begin to receive visions, they'll learn that the only way to cure the sickness is for themselves to become a shaman. Sometimes also people get struck by lightning and are instantly dosed with a hit of shamanic knowledge. So there are a bunch of different ways.
Let's go to some calls. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, hi, you all. I'm calling because I would like to see our government make some changes. I'm an herbalist of sorts, and I think the plants do have a fine medicine for all of us, as you, Daniel, have hinted. Now, as I understand it, one of the things that you did that was not talked about too much on this program was when you went to West Africa, you came with in contact with an herb called Ibotabernath. Is that how you pronounce it?
Something like that, yeah.
James Arthur had turned me on to that, but he said, you know, our country has made it a Schedule 1, meaning you can't use it. But it's not addictive, and yet it would cure people from the alcohol problems, the various bad drug problems like cocaine and heroin and so forth.
How does it work?
Actually, I don't think that it's a cure. I mean, it's a treatment, and it's a very powerful treatment tool. It might actually be the most powerful treatment tool, but it really is a tool. It's not a cure. And it seems to work in different ways. I mean, it actually seems to, it's a very long trip, iboga, and it's very psychological in that you process a lot of past material. It also has a kind of cynical sense of humor to it, which is kind of tough. It's like sort of tough love, you know. But it also seems to have a kind of biochemical level in which it either reintegrates the brain hemispheres, that's one theory, or it resets the addiction receptors, so that people who are addicted to opiates especially, after one ibogaine treatment, no longer have craving, don't really have much in the way of withdrawal symptoms, and have an opportunity to kind of change their life pattern. But the opportunity, you know, it still comes back to where they're at. I mean, if they go back into their old habits, into their old mindset, they'll end up back in the same place with the drugs. But at least it gives people a few months to make a change in their life pattern if they're ready for that.
You know, I sometimes think that this planet has the ability to give us all cures and, in this particular case, maybe allow us to reach into the other realms that we couldn't normally.
Right. I mean, I think that the future, in a way, is going to be post-technological, and that we're going to become much more interested in the, you know, possibility of creating a kind of garden planet with using technology much more sparingly and stripping away a lot of the technosphere that we've already created.
Indeed. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Daniel Pinchback. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Leonard calling from Gadsden, Alabama on WAAX Wax Radio.
Welcome to the program, Leonard.
All right, as I say over here, I have wax in my ears. Okay, I have three quick questions for your guest, please, relating to tobacco. Was tobacco smoking ever involved in a religious ceremony? Are there negative, positive spirits involved with tobacco? And what positive method is there in using tobacco spiritually?
Tobacco is actually one of the most sacred plants of North and South American shamanism. I mean, obviously, you know about the pipe rituals in North American Indian cultures. And in South America, it's actually used, they use a very powerful strain, Nicotina rustica, I think it's called, and they'll make potent shakes out of it, of tobacco juice, which they'll then drink and become unconscious.
Oh, my.
And go out and see visions. It's also used synergistically with ayahuasca. I mean, it's definitely a major shamanic intoxicant.
Must be a lot of things on this planet that that they have at their disposal.
Yeah.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. Thanks for that call. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is a great show.
Well, thank you. And where are you calling from first?
I'm calling from Gold Hill in Oregon.
Okay.
And I have a question. I studied briefly shamanism with Michael Harner. Daniel, you're familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed when I was studying with Michael, and also I did some soul retrieval, that I would have amazing synchronicity coming up all the time in my life, you know, coincidences. So, and, you know, the rational mind kind of says, oh, it's just, you know, don't pay any attention to it. But I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about, my feeling was that it was sort of non-ordinary reality, uh-huh, sort of manifesting for guidance.
Yeah, I mean, synchronicities are definitely a huge element that I'm talking about in the book that I'm finishing. Mm-hmm. Well, it's in the last book, too. But, you know, Carl Jung talked about them as being revealing kind of a causal ordering principle to reality. And they're giving us this clue that time is not just this kind of straightforward linear projection that the material culture proposes. It's actually synchronized and linked to the evolution of consciousness. So I think that, and it really became a kind of experiential, ontological method for me to sort of follow synchronicities deeper and deeper and to really stay with them. Then if you sort of get too excited about them, they tend to fade away. So you have to sort of approach them with a certain level of calm detachment and yet realize that they're indicating certain kind of flows, you know.
So you have to kind of fact-check your synchronicity then.
Exactly. I think that you have to learn a kind of weird... I mean, that's where, you know, it's about balancing the intuitive and the rational mind. You know, first, you know, you realize that this is going on, and then you sort of try to find a way to work with it as a new kind of paradigm of reality. But that's totally also what the Mayan calendar is about. The whole calendar, they have this 260-day grid where each day is a tone. And by knowing your birth date, you get a tone, and then you're part of this whole, like, tonal harmonic structure, which is all about, you know, synchronicities and resonances across the structure.
Okay, so there's something to pay attention to, but also to keep some sort of checking going on in your life. Like, I notice they come up more when I'm in turmoil.
Right, right. I mean, that's classic. I mean, it's like the kind of new pattern, the new sort of psychic pattern is constellating, and that's when synchronicities tend to kind of proliferate, you know. And, yeah, I mean, you have to pick and choose, you know.
Okay,
don't
thank
pick
you.
Every doorway.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for being part of the program. Let's move next to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Hannah from Seattle.
Hello, Hannah.
And, hi, I've read your book, Mr. Pinchback, Breaking Open the Head. And I was wondering, you said you had an experience in DMT where you met certain, like, entities, or at least entities were involved in you know, talking to you through your consciousness or whatever. I mean, I guess that's what I got from it. And I was wondering, what were these entities like, and what did you feel their intentions were?
Right. Well, I mean, at this point, I've had a lot of different experiences like this. And in fact, since the finishing of the last book, like the sort of ayahuasca and ibogaine experiences became very, like, message-oriented, which really surprised me. Like the last ayahuasca session in Brazil, there were these, I felt like I was communing with these kind of cosmic thought beings, and they put this phrase in my mind, which I then had to, like, reach for my notebook, even in my stoned state, to write it down, and it was, you go deeper into the physical to get to the infinite. When I took ibogaine, there was a series of communications. It was almost like a journalistic interview where I would ask questions. And my friend was also doing it at the same time. This was not in Africa. This was in a clinic in Mexico. A friend of mine was doing it at the same time. And, for instance, he had an experience where, you know, he was sort of thinking to himself, oh, how can I help humanity? What can I do to save civilization? And this answer came roaring back in his head, clean up your room. So, you know, it seems like on that level the entities have been pretty accurate. I did have one experience that I described in the book on a substance called DPT, dipropyltryptamine, that was more kind of diabolic or demonic or trickstery. It wasn't really verbal communication, but it was the sense of a kind of shadowy figure kind of, you know, sort of tailing me, and then I began to have poltergeist phenomena in my house. It kind of opened me up to this whole occult realm that I hadn't really believed in until that point.
Of the shamans that are around different cultures on this planet, they've been, of course, the Australian tribes, Brazil, every place.
Yeah.
Is there one group a little more advanced than the other, Daniel?
Well, I think the shamanism, you know, I mean, that's what I said in Breaking Open the Head. It's a universal human phenomenon. And I don't know if you can really talk about advanced. I mean, I think that the Mayan culture was the full flowering of the shamanic consciousness. It was kind of the shamanic visionary perspective elaborated, you know, as profoundly as the Tibetan Buddhist elaborated their sacred culture. So I guess that was the most advanced that there's been. I mean, it also seems like there are different sort of, it's almost like, I mean, in the Kabbalah, they talk about God had scattered kind of sparks or shards around the world, so that had to be kind of picked back up and put back together. It's like there are different pieces and elements in all these different cultures that we can now recombine. And that includes, you know, the different sacred plants, like working with the African plant and ayahuasca. I mean, that's something that wasn't available to people before, you know, the last couple decades.
All right, let's move on to our wild card line. Where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hi. Am I on?
Yes, sir.
Great. My name is Ruben. I'm calling from San Francisco. And I had a couple quick comments about, one was about the calendar, the Mayan calendar. In 1582, I believe, we lost 10 days. The calendar jumped from October 4th to October 15th. So that got me wondering that if the end of the Mayan calendar is December 21st, it might actually be December 31st, which is New Year's, and which is a day for a lot of celebrations. Comment about that. Then my other quick comment is crop circles seem to possibly be messages from our future selves that we're sending back through time. As if sending email messages through time rather than through space. And my comment about that. And then third thing.
Wait,
I've already forgotten the first one, to be honest. What was the first comment about?
About the the calendar date possibly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to say, I hope you figured that out properly.
I mean, you know, but, you know, it's all, when you look at these different interpretations, I mean, one thing that's really become more and more clear, I mean, this is what I was trying to say about what the crop circles taught me about the nature of reality, is that truth is not an absolute. I mean, Nietzsche said that, you know, maybe it's just our, you know, ridiculous, you know, this is this dualistic idea, there's a truth and a falsity. Maybe truth is more like levels of values, like a painter uses in a painting. You know, so we have to get off these kind of dualistic, I mean, we're trying to move into a more non-dualistic framework for thinking. So we have to get off this dualistic, like, truth, non-truth. I mean, you know, when you look at these different readings of the Mayan material, they're all slightly different. Just like Arguelles proposes his slightly different calendar. But when you put it all together, you know, it's just like looking at occult cosmologies in general. There's always a differentiation. It's like different kinds of Baroque music or different composers or something. But then you pick up the whole pattern and you realize that there's this incredible thing being revealed there. But there, once again, it requires an integration of intuitive and rational consciousness.
How did we get the 2012 date from the Mayan calendar? Was that deciphered? Was it decoded?
Yeah, deciphered. It's all over the place. And it's also, according to Jenkins, it's all over their sculptures, too, because they're constantly pointing to the plane of the ecliptic and the Milky Way and the sort of orientation of the ball courts. I mean, he did an amazing job sort of putting all this information together in his book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, so that the whole civilization for 1,000 years or more was oriented, Toltec and Mayan, towards establishing this particular date, this event that they knew was going to take place. And he actually talks about how there were two different traditions that then came together and integrated at Chichen Itza. So Chichen Itza represented the kind of integration of two thought streams that for 1,000 years have been trying to establish this exact end date and how it was going to take place.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing? This is Colin from Seattle.
Hello, Colin. Welcome.
I have a couple comments and a question for Daniel about the Mayan prophecies that was written by Maurice Quatero and some of his work. First, I'd like to just thank you for the show. This is awesome. This is something I've been waiting for a long time.
You are welcome.
And some of the verbiage that he's been using is the same stuff that I talk about to my friends when I'm trying to explain them the dynamics of the underlying structure in the universe and consciousness.
And what do they say? Language. What do they say when you talk that way? They understand you?
Well, sometimes they do. Sometimes it's just like throwing a brick off a wall. But, you know, that's their level of awareness, and it's not their time yet, and hopefully...
What's your question?
I want to know your opinion of some of the work that Maurice Quatero did down in Palenque with Bacall's tomb and some of the stuff that he found, and referencing that to he also wrote a book called the Tutankhamun Prophecies,
right,
and Viscocha in Peru. And
I had mixed
about all of that stuff.
I had mixed feelings when I saw him give a presentation and read some of his material. It seemed a little bit kind of Carnival Barker-ish. Like I felt like I was reading P.T. Barnum or something. It's got a little bit of that shamanic trickster element to it. However, some of the picture material where he basically took these, I can't remember his whole system.
They're like overlays pieces. Or something.
What's
yeah.
that?
He had them in an overlay fashion.
Exactly, and then he saw there was some kind of angle. There might be some. There could be something there, perhaps. You know, but once again, as I would say, truth is not absolute. And to him, it seemed a little bit more on the kind of trickster level.
Is your approach more scientific or more metaphysical?
I think the universe is a great work of art.
All right. Who's the artist?
We all are.
Yeah.
If we want to be.
We should be. Some are good artists, some are bad.
Well, let's try to be good artists.
Absolutely. And I don't mean just by spirituality. Some of us just should try a little bit better at the talent to do that. And, I think they could make a change.
Yeah. But I think my method is scientific in a strange way. I mean, because it's like, but it's scientific rooted in subjectivity, you know, rather than, I mean, and that also seems to be where quantum physics has kind of ended up, that there isn't even a place for an objective observer. As John Archibald Wheeler said, you know, it's a participant universe. Everybody is participating. And I think that's where we're sort of realizing more and more. And once again, that comes down to what I was saying about the crop circles, that it's about understanding that the nature of reality is subjective. And what you bring to the table is what gets reflected back to you.
Let's go right back to the phones with our guest, Daniel Pinchback. Let's go to our wild card line. First of all, you're up. Hi. Where are you calling from?
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Hi, it's Evan from Ventura.
Evan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Daniel, I have a couple questions for you real quick. I first want to say that I think the psychedelic experience has obviously been, you know, vastly demonized by our current culture and probably has a place for individuals in a therapeutic setting. But that being said, the examples you've given of the flowering of shamanic society, whether Mayan or Tibetan, don't necessarily point to a very successful or positive outcome for the integration of this kind of culture to advance humanity. The Mayans certainly disappeared either because of ecological mismanagement or constant warfare, at least that's the common theory, also practiced a great deal of human sacrifice and blood ritual, and basic sort of religious theocratic domination of their society. The Tibetans, though, you know, the Dalai Lama is a pretty groovy guy and all, still sort of would adhere to a political theocracy, the idea of a selection of a god king from an exclusively male Tibetan ethnic stock. And the lamasteries themselves were built mostly of conscript labor, not really a real advanced society from the humanistic standpoint.
Well, I think that's why, you know, we have to look at humanity as an evolutionary process, you know, and I think, like, you know, in a way that's also for me like the meaning of Christ and Christianity, which is not ever really quite taken as probably to the extent it should, but that was, you know, but the moral of that is to kind of, you know, sacrifice to create a truly human world. And I think you're a little bit exaggerating the Mayan situation from what I know about them. And I also, I mean, I think it's an interesting possibility that the classical Mayan civilization ended when they had fulfilled their mission, which was to leave this information about time behind for us to pick up. And I also think that, you know, we don't really know what the hierarchical situation there was. I mean, artists were definitely very highly prized in that culture. You know, it may have been a much more happy situation compared to what else was available in the world at that point. And, you know, the Tibetans, you know, I mean, I went to Dharamsala and I could see the incredible reverence and joy that the ordinary Tibetans got from the Dalai Lama. So, you know, those may not be perfect civilizations, but I think we have to see that we're in an evolving process and where we're trying to sort of, you know, put the hemispheres together. And that's why also I think the Hopis are an interesting example in that they seem to have been completely anti-authoritarian and non-hierarchical. One way to look at this whole 2012 thing also is Arguelles talked a lot about the nuosphere, which is sort of the mind of the planet, which may involve a kind of collective telepathic synchronization, which may make a lot of things available to us which are not now available to us.
Still with us?
I think those are really good answers. I think as far as the Maya go, there is substantial evidence they either suffered an ecological disaster based on their farming techniques that they couldn't get their way out of.
I don't think that's clear at all. That's Jared Diamond's perspective. But I mean, there are some of the Mayan farming techniques are now being revived, being rediscovered and revived because they turn out to be ecologically very sound. I think it was a very clever civilization, and that we've actually imposed our modern materialist perspective that there had to be this particular reason for a collapse. And I think that as I said, they may have just checked out at a certain point when they'd fulfilled their goal, which was to build these civilizations, which then actually had to disappear so they could be rediscovered in a certain time sequence. I mean, they were obsessed with time and synchronicity and harmonization. That was like the basis of their whole culture.
I don't think there's a lot of archaeological evidence to back that up, but I certainly accept that as a viewpoint. I guess where I was more sort of going is that the psychedelic experience is a fascinating state of consciousness. I think if we're going to push it forward as a way to change and integrate society, there needs to be a more concrete model. And I think looking around the world today, you see a tremendous amount of negative impact brought by adherence to spirituality and particularly to theocracy. And maybe we need to steer away from mystic states and start looking at more rational-centered ideas for changing societies on the planet.
Well, I don't think, I don't think mysticism and rationality are mutually exclusive. In fact, I think they can be integrated. And I think that we don't see a lot of problems from esoteric disciplines. We don't see a lot of problems from, you know, yogis and Sufis and, you know, even modern-day shamans. We see problems from, fundamentalist religions and monotheistic, you know, antiquated patriarchal systems. And those probably, you know, are fundamentally flawed and are not going to be capable of sustaining themselves through this transition.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Daniel.
Hi.
This is Jim from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, I wanted to ask you, someone else asked you about verbiage, and something you, a phrase you used earlier was our sick Western condition. Now, I assume you use a computer and that you've flown to all these places you've been to, and these are products of our sick Western condition, whereas these people you visited are happy to take their psychedelics and defecate in trenches and live in hovels. Is that what you wish for us?
Well, I mean, first of all, it seems to me that you're coming with a huge amount of cultural baggage. You talk about them defecating in trenches and live in hovels. Actually, the only people who are defecating in trenches or living in hovels are those who've been subjected to our sick Western mentality and, the conditions we've imposed upon the planet. When I went to visit the tribe, the Sequoia were still living in the rainforest. I saw some of their ancestral dwellings, and they were sort of like rainforest cathedrals. I mean, the most harmonic structures I've ever been inside. And so I think that's a huge imposition on your part. I mean, yeah, I would say that our sick Western condition is basically a kind of mass soul loss, incapacity to confront the consequences of our own actions, and something that we're needing as individuals and collectively to take responsibility for. And I would say what's happening right now is a collective shadow projection, as Jung would say, where we are constantly blaming the other. We're constantly talking about defecating in the trenches. I mean, where does the defecation in New York go? It's put on a barge and shipped somewhere else. You know, I mean, we're constantly in a projection mode, and our technology is also involved in that. So I think we need to fundamentally rethink the basis of our civilization. Yeah.
But you're happy to use the technology, aren't you?
You use the system that exists to create the system that you want to be.
Okay, Jim, thank you for your call. Let's move up next to our first time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, this is Joe from Cliff Village.
Yeah, that's in Missouri, isn't it?
Yep,
I remember.
Missouri.
Sure thing.
I'm an ayahuasquero from Cliff Village here. And I had a question at the end of this, but I wanted to tell you about an experience I had real quick. And it's funny that you mentioned the whole idea of us being great artists before the break, because I believe that the paradigm shift in the hemispheres of the brain really ties to a swinging of the polarity between the old idea of a warrior hero, the Achilles-type warrior hero, to more of an artisan hero, more of a shamanic music maker, an entertainer, someone who can invoke joy. And that's really the idea behind a lot of stuff McKenna was talking about bringing physical things into existence, was actually the act of invoking that joy in people. And I say this because I was, for most of my life, I was I raised a football player, went into the Navy, did a bunch of was really gung-ho for destruction. And then on May the 5th of the year 2000, I had an experience where some people came together and I was administered LSD, mushrooms, and pretty high amounts of marijuana. And at some point in time in the night, everybody came together and basically told me what a tried egomaniac I was and said, this is the point when you die on acid. And when they said this, they pointed their fingers at me and everything in the room stopped. And there were six old men standing in the corner who were saying, grandson, your life isn't going very good this way. You need to do something different. And I saw what looked like arrows come from the directions and like from the sky and from the ground and shot into my heart. And I basically began a spiritual journey that ended me up in London, England, and under another...
That's a nice story, but do you have a question?
Yeah, well, my question is actually... I was actually going to say something about the idea of using something spiritually as far as better than using it recreationally. You know, there are two ways to use a substance. Jesus used alcohol spiritually, not recreationally. Tobacco is used spiritually. It can, when you use something recreationally, you really open yourself up to a lot of negative recourse. But my question really was, do you think there should be emerging not only of Eastern ideologies in the form of Kriya Yoga meditation type research along with shamanic plants, and not only from the East to the West? What do you think about merging the Mesoamerican Indian cultures, the ayahuasqueros, with the peyote, peyote sweat?
Hello?
You there?
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I've been working with a teacher, and she's actually been bringing people from the Native American church down to South America to introduce them to the ayahuasca traditions. So I think that's an interesting way to go.
Let's. How much time do we have left? A couple more calls. Let's pick it up by going to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George. This is Jason calling in from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Jason.
Hi. I also follow the 13-moon, 28-day calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wanted to ask your guest somewhat about the symbolism. I'm a red spectral skywalker, which from my point of origin sort of defines my life as a world time traveler, as I understand, and seems to appear throughout my life. But I was if you could explain some of the symbolism between the solar seeds and...
It's actually not my area of specialty. I mean, and as I was saying, although I appreciate the 13-moon calendar, and I think it has its own validity, I was mapped onto it like very elegantly when I met Arguelles. I think what's ultimately going to be necessary is a kind of a sort of meeting of minds to create a new timing frequency that actually could be generally applicable for the planet and would help us move into a kind of new framework. I mean, I think Arguelles did a fundamentally amazing thing by sort of recognizing that such a tool, such an instrument could be of value. But I think there's another stage that it needs to be taken to.
If we did that, what's the benefit for it? I mean, what would happen?
Well, first of all, we would resynchronize with natural time. It would be a meeting of scientific minds and spiritual traditions. So in itself would be a kind of concord. It would be a kind of making a kind of
harmonic
new concordance.
Yeah.
And then it would have the fabulous benefit of delegitimizing all of the nation state charters and institutions that currently exist. So we'd be able to start again, hopefully from a global harmonic paradigm. But obviously this is a very idealistic perspective, unless this whole idea of the noosphere is correct. And as we come into alignment with that, it may become possible for us to think in these ways, breaking down dualisms.
We've got a calendar system, Daniel, which is much like our monetary system, where we don't have gold backing it anymore. They just keep making it and making it.
Exactly. It's all part of the same process.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
My question is about the... like salvia divinorum, and if it was used in sacrificial rituals, like I heard that, like
in sacrificial or sacramental. I mean, I don't think it was used
sacrificial. Like I heard it was used, like they made the people smoke it, and then like when they thought their soul left their body, they sacrifice in Aztecs.
Well, I never heard that. I mean, all I know is that it was used by the Mazatec Indians, who seems very peaceful to me when I visited them.
How powerful was that?
I've done it a few times, and it's quite powerful. I mean, you can do it different ways. The thing that's interesting about salvia is that it's like a completely different experience than any other psychedelic, and it's almost like gives you a totally different perception of time and space. It's sort of like you normally feel that it's almost like orthogonal. It's like you're moving into some like diagonal direction from our normal time and space, and it really, for me, it's like it's an incredible indicator of how much, you know, is left to be discovered. And I really think that the hyper-dimensional object that physicists are working on and looking at is ultimately the psyche. And these different compounds and techniques are ways of kind of traversing this object at different trajectories, which give you, you know, lead you into different relationships, different beings appear. I mean, here we have a realm for post-history, you know, for where we'll go after 2012, where we have, you know, millions of years ahead of exploration.
Do you think 2012 is the strike date? That's the date we should all be interested in, concerned about?
No, I think we better be concerned about it right now.
That's what I thought.
That's why I'm trying to do this magazine project, Medicine. You know, what I see is that there are all these systems and ideas that have been developing, you know, since the 60s, a lot of them beyond, like how to use organic material to kind of bioremediate toxified land using mushrooms or living machines made of microorganisms, creating new currencies that instill like a different value system through an economy, so you could actually have a currency that instilled a compassionate value systems. I think there's a whole bunch of ideas that have been developed that could be put together as a paradigm and then implemented as this current paradigm begins to self-destruct.
All right. Well, the website, of course, is breakingopenthehead.com. His book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey to the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism. What will the title be? Do you have a title yet for the second book?
Well, I assume it'll be 2012, subtitled The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
Okay. So
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Daniel. Take care. Daniel Pinchbeck is his name. If you need to go to his website, of course, it's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. And I, of course, fresh back from a two-day jaunt in Hawaii where we had just a great event out there with the people at KHVH and all of you, of course, who attended. And I tell you, first time in Hawaii, and what a gorgeous state we have over there. Our guest tomorrow, by the way, first hour, Richard C. Hoagland, is going to talk a little bit about Coral Castle, Saturn, and Mars. And then our main guest, Dr. David Humes, as we talk about mysticism and intuition. And then on Wednesday, the great debate, James McCanney and Dr. David Morrison, as they battle it out over the theories of Velikovsky. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.